Hello, everyone. This is Steve Martin. Welcome to Stars on Tap. Today is October the 15th, 2014. Our guest today has hits like Sheila and Dizzy. He's got some new projects that he's worked on. This is Tommy Rowe. Welcome, Tommy. How are you?
Hey, Steve. Good to talk to you.
Yes, sir. Always enjoy talking to Tommy Rowe.
Well, thank you. It's always my pleasure. I mean, I think we did an interview last year when I had my country release out.
And, yeah.
So you're covering a lot of bases from country to pop, right?
I'm trying. the first thing I thought we would discuss is your early years, especially the '60s. You want to tell us a little bit about those years?
Well, you know, I got started very young. I wrote Sheila, of course, when I was about 14 years old. My dad taught me three chords on the guitar, and I started immediately trying to write songs. I was kind of a shy kid, so I never dreamed I would actually be performing my songs, but, you know, I thought I would write for other artists, you know. But eventually, you know, when Sheila became a hit in 1962, I of course, recorded the record, and I then had to learn how to perform because I wasn't much of a professional when I first started. I just kind of by the seat of the pants, I went out on the road and started learning by failure. So it all happened at a very young age for me, and so I would tour around the Southeast and through the Midwest. When I first started, I did a lot of ballrooms through the Midwest, and when I was learning my craft, and I worked with a lot of different bands, so I got the feel of how it was on the road before I really did any professional touring. So Sheila, of course, was the beginning for me, and like I say, I was like 20 years old when it was a hit, so I was a young whippersnapper, as we say down south.
That's pretty cool.
The Justin Bieber of the '60s, that's who I was.
Oh, no. Oh, man. That's quite a thing to say about yourself.
Oh, God.
But that's really cool how you got started, and so where did it lead from there after Sheila?
Well, of course, Sheila was number one in the U.S., and, you know, when Sheila was released, it wasn't the A-side of the record. Save Your Kisses was the A-side of the record.
I did not know that.
And we played, you know, we got a little airplay on Save Your Kisses here and there, but it never really took off. And then there was a DJ in Baltimore by the name of Buddy Dean who had a afternoon dance show, a la Dick Clark, you know, like American Bandstand,
sure.
But it was local in Baltimore.
Mm-hmm.
And he also had a radio program, and he flipped the record over and played the B-side, which was Sheila. And as we used to say in the old days, the phones lit up, which meant, you know, he started getting a lot of requests for it. So we knew right away from Buddy's response, he got in touch with my manager and said, you know, this record that you have out, it's the B-side that's the hit version, the hit side. So he told us about flipping the record and the response he got. So we started promoting Sheila, and of course, it turned out to be the record. But it also went to number one in England in 1962, and I was touring through the year of 62. I toured with Sam Cooke and Jerry Butler of the Impressions, a lot of different acts in the South, from the South, R&B acts, really.
Mm-hmm.
And so my experience with them and my relationship with Chris Montez on those early tours, which, you know, Chris was a part of those tours as well. Then we got a call in 63 for Chris and I to headline our own tour in England. So, of course, I jumped at that. I think the furthest I've been out of the Southeast was maybe Savannah, Georgia, and that was still, you know, that was not out of the state. So
mm-hmm.
I had done a lot of traveling. So when we got the offer to do the tour over in England, we jumped at it, and Chris and I accepted the tour, and promoted by Arthur House. And that was the tour that the Beatles were featured at with us on our tour. And that was my first meeting of the Beatles. So that was in 1963.
Wow. Can you tell us a little bit about touring with the Beatles?
Well, when we first got there, you know, we had a meeting before the tour started, and actually it's kind of a rehearsal with the band and going over the show routine and everything. and the Beatles walked in. And I actually thought at first the Beatles were our backup band. I mean, nobody knew who the Beatles were in 1963.
Right.
I mean, they were just an up-and-coming band, you know. So finally I realized they were a featured act on our show, and so they were going to be a part of our show. And we started the tour, and everything was going well at first. You know, it was Chris and I were headlining the tour, and then the Beatles just kind of, their fan base started developing during our tour. I always like to say, you know, because of Chris and I, the Beatles were, our tour was really the springboard for their career, because after that, they never were a featured act on any other tours. They were always the headliners after our tour. So, and the tour turned out to be good for all of us because, of course, the Beatles went on to, from that tour to do many other tours in England, and then they came to the States in 1964. And when they did the Ed Sullivan Show, a few days after that, they went down to Washington, D.C. and did their first American concert. And they invited me to open the show for them there in Washington, D.C. in 1964, February 11th, 1964. So, of course, I was pleased to do that. We developed a good relationship during the tour. And actually, Brian Epstein was talking to me about managing me. You know, what's interesting is that none of us at that young age had a clue what was in store for us. I mean, all we wanted was a hit record, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I guarantee you the Beatles, and I know Brian Epstein, they didn't have a clue what their destiny was going to be. I mean, they were just happy at that point to come to America to be able to perform in America. And, they used to talk to me on the bus traveling around England. They had so many questions about what is it like to be in America. They would ask about different cities, you know, Nashville and Massachusetts. They wanted to know if that meant Buddy Holly and all these just typical questions that, you know, you would ask. If I met a star, I would ask the same kind of questions, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So, in a way, it was kind of just, they were just trying to get a hit record. They were very fortunate to be on the Ed Sullivan Show, and they did. And Brian Epstein, as far as I'm concerned, was the genius behind breaking these guys, because he was a great manager. He was kind of like a Colonel Tom Parker. You know, he'd take advantage of all these little situations. You know, like on tour, you know, he'd have the fans follow them backstage, and they would be screaming outside the theater for them and the whole thing. And they had all this excitement going for them, you know. So he was really a big-time promoter. And so when we did the show in Washington, D.C., that was kind of the springboard for them in the States. And after that show, you know, they just took off. And of course, they wrote one hit after another. And I think the success of the Beatles also relied heavily on the writing of Paul McCartney and John Lennon. I mean, the songs they were writing were terrific songs. And I think if they hadn't been able to write their own material, they would have had a tough time continuing their career. As most artists, if you didn't write your own songs, you always had a hard time getting a hit song, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I think their songwriting was the key to it. And of course, the great management of Brian Epstein. And they were talented, you know. They're very talented guys.
Oh, absolutely. You know, they wrote very simple things that, you know, stuck in people's heads that, you know, and Brian Epstein came a long way from running a record store, wouldn't you think? He kind of
absolutely. He was a genius.
He was a genius.
Yeah, he had a stable of artists when I worked with the Beatles in England. He had Jerry and the Pacemakers, and he had, of course, the Beatles, and he had an act called Tommy Quickly, who Tommy recorded one of my songs in England. Called You Might As Well Forget Him. And so he was building the stable of artists, and that's why he was talking to me about managing me. You know, he wanted to manage me in England, in Europe, in England. And of course, I had a manager in the States, but he wanted to do it for us in England. And by the time we got down to talking about contracts and everything, the Beatles took off. He didn't have time to manage anybody but the Beatles, you know, so he just, he got, you know, just took on the Beatles. He let all the other artists go, and he just went with the Beatles, which was a smart thing to do because his hands were full managing those guys.
You know, it took a while for them to come to the forefront. They paid their dues and played their dues all over Germany and England, of
right.
course. And you know, it's
yeah.
just it's almost like Epstein kind of fell into being a genius.
Yeah, you know, a lot of times things have to fall into place for you. You know, after I finished the tour in 1963 with the Beatles, I went to Germany and I did the Star Club. You know, I was formed over there after our tour. And everybody was talking about the Beatles singing Sheila in their show. They used to do Sheila in their show at the Star Club.
Wow.
And in fact, when I first met the guys and we were touring our first few days on the tour, John came up to me and said, you know, we've been doing your song Sheila in our show. And he said, the strange thing is, after hearing you do it live, I think we're playing the chords wrong. And I said, well, how were you doing it? So he took the guitar and he played the chord progression. And sure enough, he had the chords backwards. He was playing A-D-E instead of A-E-D. And they just had it turned around backwards. And I said, yeah, you know, you just flip it around and the E comes before the D, you know, so... you know, we had a big laugh about that, and they said, well, I doubt if we'd be doing it anymore now, but it's good to know that I find out a little late that we're playing it wrong. There was actually a crude recording of Sheila. Somebody recorded on a home tape machine in the Star Club of Sheila. It was out like a bootleg record for a while. I have a copy of it somewhere. It's really crude and not very good, but George Harrison was singing it. And, you know, it was just kind of a neat thing for me to have, you know.
Oh, absolutely. You know, I don't want to sit here and take up all your time with the Beatles, but, you know, as an autograph collector, I got to ask you, do you have any autographs from the Beatles? I know it's a dumb question.
I've never asked for autographs in my life.
Really?
And I didn't ask for theirs. I had a lot of photographs that we took. Some of them I have on my website, TommyRowe.com.
Uh-huh.
And I had a lot of my road manager at the time, his name Cotton Carey, he worked for my manager. And he had a little brownie camera, and he took a bunch of pictures of us together on the bus and backstage and all this. And my mom put all these photographs in an album. And, you know, my cousins and friends would come over to the house when I was out of town and look at the album. Gradually, all those photographs disappeared. So I think I have about two left.
Oh, wow.
Out of all, we had 20 or 30 different candid shots of them. But, yeah, you know, anybody that breathes the same air as the Beatles, they're interested in talking to you about it. I mean, it's like when I did the Washington, D.C. thing this year. They had the 50th anniversary show in Washington, D.C., and mm-hmm. they invited me to recreate my opening act for the Beatles, you know, which I did. And the press on that thing was just phenomenal. They wanted to talk to me continuously about that night with the Beatles and what it was like. And, you know, to tell you the truth, it was just chaotic, like our tour was in England. It was so much chaos, it was hard to hear them. I mean, you can hear them better on the tape that they have out now, the video, than you could in the auditorium. I mean, you couldn't hear them at all, really. Mm. And that's the way it was on our tour as well. I always like to think of the Beatles as four Elvis Presleys. I remember when I went to see Elvis the first time, I was just a kid in high school here in Atlanta. He came through to Atlanta and did a little theater down here, and I went to the show, and I thought, this was before Hound Dog. This was before he really took off with RCA Records. This was when he was on Sun Records.
Mm-hmm.
And he opened his group, Scotty Moore, and the guys came out, did a few numbers, and, you know, they got polite applause. But when Elvis walked on stage, pandemonium broke out. I'd never seen anything like that before, you know. And I remember sitting in the theater that day, and I thought, you know, he's having a lot more fun than I'm having out here. And if there's any way possible, I want to get on that stage like he is, because that's where it's all happening, you know. So that was a big inspiration for me to try to learn to perform and become a performer when I first saw Elvis. And when I saw the Beatles, it was the same thing all over again. I thought to myself, my gosh, this is like Elvis Presley all over again, with the pandemonium and the chaos that he created in the audience, except you have four of them on stage. So you have like four charismatic guys on stage at one time, and every girl in the audience, they could have their choice between four different guys, you know. So, I mean, it was like a quadruple whammy there. It's just incredible to watch, you know.
That's amazing. You know, you have to have had to have worked with some amazing stars. Other than the Beatles and Elvis, you know, that in those times.
Well, Well, I've worked with most everybody along the way. You know, like I said, when I first started, I worked with a lot of the R&B artists down south. And I used to love R&B. That's what I used to listen to when I was a kid in high school, late at night. You couldn't hear R&B during the daytime in the south. In fact, most radio was like that. It's kind of hard for kids to understand this, but, you know, back in those days, media was very limited. And in the daytime, you heard smooth pop music and maybe a little country music. And then late at night, about 11 o'clock, 10 or 11 o'clock, there was a station here in Atlanta called WAOK, and I used to listen to them. And they'd come on about 10 o'clock at night, and they'd play, you know, John Lee Hooker, and B.B. King, and Bobby Blue Bland, Jimmy Reed, and all of these R&B artists, which you never heard during the daytime. And I would stay up at night with my little transistor radio listening to these guys. And Mother used to always wonder why it was so hard for me to get up in the morning and go to school. I was under the covers listening to my transistor radio to R&B. So it was great when Sheila was a hit, and one of the first tours I did was with Sam Cooke, and I was a huge fan of Sam Cooke because he wrote his own songs. You know, he was a songwriter. That's really what I wanted to be, was a songwriter. So when I got booked on the Sam Cooke tour down through the Southeast, I thought that was fabulous. And it turns out that you know, one of the reasons I was on this tour, which is kind of a funny story, you know, the Southeast, you know, at that time in 62, everything was still segregated. So the black artists, they couldn't just go into any hotel or motel. In fact, there were no such things as Holiday Inn or Ramada Inns, any kind of hotels like that. They're all mom and pop places.
Mm-hmm.
So, and they couldn't go into restaurants. They had to, very few restaurants they could go into. So they always had one white act on the show to get the food. So I, you know, they would park down the street, and I would go into a little mom and pop restaurant and order 30 or 40 hamburgers for the show. And that was part of my gig. You know, of course, they were happy to have me on the show with the number one record in the U.S., which Sheila was number one. But I would go out and sing two or three songs and open the show and sing two or three songs, and then that was it. You know, then it would be an R&B show after that. But, you know, my main function was to help them get food and help them to get around through the South, because it was kind of difficult. I remember they used to drop me off at the motel in the bus. You know, they'd drive the bus up and drop me off at the motel. They couldn't stay in the motel. They would go into town and stay with friends and stay with church members. And if they had a black hotel, then they'd stay there, of course. But that's the way it was down South in the early 60s. And when you talk about it with young people today, they just can't imagine it. And it is really hard to imagine they would live that way. But, you know, what's interesting, as a young person growing up in the South, you didn't think much about it because it's just what you were born into. That's the way it was, and you didn't think about it, you know. And there was no animosity towards the blacks as far as I was concerned. In fact, I used to play baseball with the blacks. You know, our neighborhoods were right side by side in Atlanta. And on the weekends, we'd play baseball together in this field that was between our neighborhoods, and we never thought anything about it, you know. But it's kind of interesting history when you think about it. And when you talk to the young people, I would like for the young people to understand how it is, because I think it is so interesting.
It is. You know, I grew up in Kentucky in the middle 60s and late 60s. I was probably 10 by 70. But, you know, I grew up in a black neighborhood. And it never occurred to me that other people didn't do the same. I mean, we had dinners together. We sat out on the porch at night in the summertime. And, you know, it's...
But you went to separate schools.
No, sir. We all went to the same school.
We went to separate schools. That's what is different about where I live. You know, we lived side by side. But we couldn't go to the same schools, you know. So we played together, but we didn't study together. It was really bizarre.
I guess, you know, I was pretty lucky to not have had to look at that. As I recall, you know, the best I can recall, I never saw a black restaurant or a sign that said no blacks or anything of that nature. And I guess Ashland, Kentucky was a little bit ahead of its time. And, you know, I appreciate that kind of stuff.
Yeah, the North was not segregated like the South was.
Exactly.
You had the deep south was Georgia, Alabama, Mississippi, and Louisiana. That was where the real segregation was, and parts of Florida as well, northern parts of Florida.
Well, I'm glad I didn't have to grow up like that.
Thank God we changed it. If it left it up to me, I'd have changed it a long time ago.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, you were talking about your transistor radio. That's exactly the way I grew up, with a transistor radio in my ear under the pillow where Mom couldn't hear it.
Yeah.
And it was all about the baseball games and, you know, the football and the basketball you could get. And it played a lot into why I want to be in radio now, is those days.
Well, when the transistor radio came along, that was a big deal.
Oh, yeah.
Because all of a sudden there was no why. You didn't have to sit at home and listen. You could carry that thing around with you, you know. I mean, that was really something. I remember that well. It was like liberating, you know, in a way. You think about it, because you'd be in the car. Of course, you could hear your music in the car, but if you left the car and went out to the park or something, there you could still listen to the radio. It was pretty amazing.
You know, it's kind of like having a smartphone these days.
Yeah, same deal.
You know?
Same deal, yeah.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, I don't want to sit and pick your brain too much about the old stuff. What I thought we'd talk about next is you put out a country album called Devil Soul Pile, which had some success. You want to tell us a bit about that country record?
Yeah, you know, Devil Soul Pile went to number one in the adult contemporary charts, independent charts, adult contemporary market, in 2012. And, you know, this is kind of an interesting song because it's totally a departure from a normal Tommy Rowe. I mean, it's like Sweet Pea and Hooray for Hazel. This is nothing like those kind of songs, you know, the bubblegum thing. But the reason this song came about, it goes back to my childhood again. You know, when I was growing up here in Atlanta, my parents always took us to church. We had church every Sunday, and, you know, on Wednesdays we had, you know, prayer meetings and all this. And then during the summertime, they would have what they call these old-fashioned revivals or camp meetings, they call them.
Yep.
And what they'd do is like a weekend or maybe a whole week sometimes, they would pitch these tents out in a field somewhere or a park where they could get space to do this. And they'd have maybe five or six tents thrown up out there. And preachers from all over the South would come and preach in these tents all day long. You'd have one preacher after another giving a sermon, you know. And then, of course, at night they'd end up with the main man. It's kind of like a rock festival for preachers, you know.
Exactly. I saw several of those.
You know, food and the whole thing. So I remember this one particular time. I was probably, I can't remember how old I was, maybe 8 or 9 years old. And I was at one of these events, and this preacher kept talking about the devil as a collector of souls, you know. And my imagination ran crazy with this because, of course, at that age, you picture the devil with the horns and the pitchfork and the whole thing. And I pictured, I had this image in my mind of him collecting these souls and storing them up somewhere, warehousing them, you know. And I'm thinking, you know, he's collecting all these souls. He's got to put them somewhere and keep them, you know. So this image just stayed with me, and it just never left my mind. So a few years ago, I think it was in 2010 or 2011, I went trout fishing with a friend of mine in California, went up to the High Sierras trout fishing. And we were driving down the road to go to the lake, and I saw this road sign that said Devil's Post Pile. Well, Devil's Post Pile is a town up in the Sierras, up in Northern California, and it's famous for these rock formations that were created millions of years ago, and they look like telephone poles inside of a mountain there. And they're all lined up just like perfectly in line, and just like one pole after another, and they're like made of stone. And so when I saw this sign, Devil's Post Pile, I thought, my goodness, that's my song title right there, Devil's Soul Pile. I just put soul instead of post, Devil's Soul Pile. And then I thought, well, you know, what am I going to write about the Devil's Soul Pile, you know? So I thought, well, maybe I'll try and make a statement with it. And I thought, since we were having so much inner city crime around L.A. and, you know, all over the country, Chicago, we're having all this inner city crime problem, maybe I'll write something about that. So that's what I did. I wrote a song about, you know, growing up in a family without a father and, you know, the negative things that can happen to you without that family environment that's so important for a young person. But I wanted to end the song with a message of hope, so I ended the song with the hope of having faith, faith in God, and be your savior from this problem. And so, like I say, that is not a typical Tommy Rowe song, and it is a message song, a religious message song, kind of subtle. It's not, it doesn't hit you in the face with the message, but it's a subtle message of how important faith is in life. And whether you believe in, you know, whatever your God is, you know, to have faith in your God. And so, you know, I wrote the song with that idea in mind, and it really took off in independent charts. Of course, radio is so different today. The independent charts are a little different than the mainstream media. But I was really proud of the song, and I was really happy to see that it was so well received by the listeners of Adult Contemporary.
Well, you know, I've got that album, and it's quite an album. I enjoy it. Anybody
well,
that would like
you,
to, if anybody would like to buy that, it's at TommyRowe.com, TommyRowe.com.
Yeah, you can get it there. I can direct you to where to pick it up. It's still up there on the website. And it's done very well. It's just very surprising this late in my career. And, you know, the songwriting thing is, again, was very important in me making this album, because I think the last album I had out was in the late 90s or mid 90s sometime. And so I had, you know, had these songs that I'd written, and I thought, well, I can't just let them sit around in the drawer, so I got to go in the studio and do something with them. So it inspired me to go back in and do an album after so much time in between releases, you know, and it's kind of cool.
Absolutely. That's awesome. Glad you could come back with something that good. On October the 27th, you're going to receive an award from BMI for 2 million performances for Sheila and Dizzy. You want to tell us about that real quick?
Right. That's really, I'm really proud of that, because it's so hard. Do you think about 2 million times your song has been played on the radio? I mean, that's a lot of performances.
It is.
So, Sheila and Dizzy both reached that, plateau this year, and so I'm flying into Nashville on the 27th. I think they're actually presenting me with the award on the 28th of this month, and so I'll get an award for Sheila and Dizzy for 2 million performances, which I'm very proud of as a songwriter. That's a big accomplishment for me.
It's a big accomplishment for anyone.
Well, any songwriter, that is so important. You know, the more times your song is played, of course, that's what makes it valuable, and that's what makes it, you know, the public, that means the public has really enjoyed listening to what you created, and that's what really makes you feel good, you know.
Absolutely. I mean, that's what you're in the business for.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
You know, that brings you to the forefront, the pinnacle of your craft when you get awards like BMI's 2 million airplays. I mean, that's quite a feat for anyone.
Yeah, it is.
You know, I'm sure when the Beatles started out, if you would have told them they only would have had 2 million plays, why, they would have, you know what I'm saying? They would have taken that and ran with it.
Yeah, they wouldn't have believed it. I mean,
exactly.
They were just happy to have a hit record. They thought they got Please Me was a hit in England. They thought they'd reached it there. They, like I said earlier, they didn't have a clue what destiny had in store for those guys.
Boy, I'm telling you. And also in Las Vegas on January 23, 24, and 25, you will be playing,
you know,
at the South Point Inn.
I've put a new show together, and I got tired of doing the oldies tribute shows a few years ago, and I retired in 2005. And then my old friend Rick Levy, who I worked with for years and years in my band before I retired, he would call me occasionally and say, you know, this guy wants to book you here, and he wants to buy. I'd say, Rick, I'm retired. I'm playing golf. I'm very happy with my retirement. But he was very persistent. He kept calling. Finally, he talked me into doing 3 dates up in Canada in 2011. And I said, Rick, the only way I'll come back is if I can have my own show and without doing the oldies thing, you know, without doing the one act after another, doing 3 or 4 songs and getting off stage. So he said, well, that's what we'll do. We'll go see if it, give it a try and see how it works. So So we went up in Canada. We did three casinos up there, and I did like an hour and 15-minute show doing my hits and doing some kind of obscure recordings and obscure songs that I've written through the years. And I do an acoustic set in the middle of the show and a Q&A in the show. So it's really a fun thing for me to do. So he talked me into it. We went back, we did a few shows, and it got better the next year. We did about 20 shows, and this year we'll do about the same 20 shows or so. And so January we started Vegas with our show at the South Point Hotel and Casino on the Strip there. Mm-hmm. And we'd like to invite everybody to come out and see us. It's a lot of fun. We do all the hits in the show, and I'm doing some of the country songs that I've recorded recently in the show. And so come visit with us. We have a good time.
Oh, absolutely. I hope you at some point make it to Lexington.
Well, we hope so. I was up in Maryland this year. We did a show up there and went over terrific. We had we sold out the show. It was about 1,500 people. So there's a lot of interest in what I'm doing. And like I say, we have a good time. It's a fun show. We have a lot of laughs. And I do a Q&A in the middle of the show where I go up to the audience and take questions from the audience. Sometimes you never know what they're going to ask you, you know, so it's got to by the seat of your pants, and you get some really interesting questions and a lot of laughs from it. It's a lot of fun to do.
Well, that's great. Like I said, I hope you at some point make it up to Lexington with our mutual friend Mike Borchetta, who keeps telling me that you guys are coming up here. So I take him at his word.
Yeah, Mike's an old friend. Mike was very instrumental in promoting Dizzy. You know, he was the one that helped break that record for me in 1969. He's a real good friend of mine. Of course, he's a big horse guy. You know, so he's
absolutely. Yeah, he comes up here to the Keeneland meets and that sort of stuff. And just at some point in time, I'd like to see you guys come up here so we can meet up.
Oh, we'll do it. Absolutely.
Absolutely. Sounds like a great time. Before I let you go, can you tell us about your website and your Facebook page and your Twitter account?
Well, I don't have a Twitter account. I have the website. It's TommyRowe.com.
Okay.
And TommyRowe.com will send you to the Facebook page. And I have a Facebook page that's being taken care of by a good friend of mine, Ron Wells, in Washington State. He's running my Facebook page for me, and he's doing a terrific job. So I just don't have time to do the Facebook thing and the Twitter on my own. You know, it's a little too much for me to handle. But he's doing a great job, and I stay in touch with him, and we stay in touch with the fans that way. So,
well, you know, I'm a friend of yours on Facebook, and you guys put out some really cool pictures. You know, I try to go in and like as many as I can, but a man that's got your history, it's kind of hard to keep up with all those pictures all the time. But I do, and I enjoy them.
You know what's interesting, Steve? A lot of those pictures are coming from fans that I didn't know that those pictures were out there. I mean, some of those pictures are a surprise to me as well. So it's kind of fun to see what the fans have kind of squirreled away through the years, and they're kind of, all of a sudden they'll pull one of these old photos out and post it on the Facebook page, and it's, you know, I say, whoa, when was that taken, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Pretty funny.
You know, it's a shame we didn't have digital.
And they cover me too when I do the concerts. They take a lot of photos and with videos as well.
You know, a lot of people, like I say, like myself, collect autographs. Do you stay around and talk to fans and sign for people if time permits?
Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely. After the show, I go out. We have a table set up to where I can sign if they bring their old records. A lot of them bring their old, albums, you know, for me to sign.
Absolutely.
I, of course, have new CDs that they can purchase, and I can sign those and photos. But, I set up after the show, we set up a table, and I sign. I love talking to the fans. I love meeting the fans. I mean, one thing about me is, you know, when I got in this business, it was never about the money with me. It was always about, you know, the love of the fans. I always had this feeling like if somebody likes me enough to come to see me, to pay to get in to see me, you know, I really owe them a good show, and I owe them my loyalty as an artist as well. So to me, the fan base has always been my main purpose, my main obligation. I feel obligated to to share with them as much of my time as I can, and I really try to do that at each show.
You know, it takes two to tango.
Yeah.
That's awesome. Well, Tommy, I really appreciate your time. Is there anything else you want to tell us before I start some credits?
I think you covered it pretty well.
I think we did.
I'm about to lose my voice here, so I think we did a pretty good job. I appreciate you inviting me on your show, Steve, and good luck with it. And all my fans over there in England, I hope to see you again soon. You know, I did the Cavern Club, the 50th anniversary of the Beatles at the Cavern Club this year, and we had a great show there, and they're talking about bringing us back over there, so maybe I'll see my British fans in shortly as well.
That's awesome. If you'll hang on just a moment. Don't hang up. All right. I need to let everyone know that Stars on Tap is brought to you by LexingtonBroadcasting.com's Kickin' Country USA for the very best and top 40 country music on the internet. I'd like to mention our co-producer, Miss Rhea Roma of Los Angeles. She runs an animal rescue shelter in the greater Los Angeles area. We really thank Rhea for what she does for us here at Stars on Tap. I'd like to mention Betty Martin. She's our technical advisor. What I can't fix, Betty can. What I don't understand, she does. So we appreciate what Betty does, and we love her as always. Thank you, Betty. I'd like to mention our radio affiliates, which are Space Coast iRadio out of Melbourne, Florida. Jimmy Lawson runs a country station in Florida and plays this show and a couple others that we run. And also I'd like to mention Steve Harris of Starlight UK and Soul USA Radio over in the UK for playing this show. I'd also like to mention OperationBlanketsOfLove.org, where you can take a blanket or a sheet, a towel, any kind of a linen item, and donate it to a shelter for an animal to lay on and get warm and wait to be adopted. I'd also like to mention SavingK9LivesPlus.org. My friend Bobby Kimball runs this rescue center in the greater Los Angeles area, and they need help all the time as well. And I'd also like to thank God for the opportunity of being here with you today. And as always, enjoy your music.